very intriguing subject this morning that I suspect most people haven't thought of. Do we realize that there are 4.5 billion human beings on this planet, no one of them be able to change places with any other human being? We have no actual insight of sharing the central motivations of anyone but ourselves. We cannot fully understand the reasons for the conduct of any other person. Sometimes we think we can approximate their motives, but we are not sure. Nor are we aware of the circumstances that led to these motives. Each person lives in a little world of his own, completely isolated from everyone else. We have created a number of different methods of communication in an effort to help this situation, but these are totally inadequate when it comes to the effort to search into the basic principle behind another person. They will tell us what they think. Very often they haven't been thinking. They tell us what they believe, and sometimes it's pretty bad. Sometimes they explain their reason for life, and it will sound unreasonable to everyone but themselves. And this it is with all of us. The other person's attitudes are reprehensible. When we make the same mistakes, we have obvious reason why we could do nothing else. Another person loses their temper, it's because they have a bad disposition. If we lose ours, it is righteous indignation. Every good motive is reserved for ourselves. Every bad motive is usually saved for someone else. All the mistakes we make are blamed on other people. If so-and-so hadn't done this or that, we wouldn't be in the present dilemma. Also, with all of this internal self-justification, we continue to live strangely complex and untruthful lives. Day after day, we keep on dreaming of something better. We want to improve. We want to grow. But between ourselves and this golden time we look for is a complex personality that has so long controlled us that we do not even have the facility to question its domination. Years ago, I knew a family in which the man of the house had a great fondness for old clothes, and his wife had a great determination to get rid of them. She bought him a brand new suit, which hung magnificently in the shelf, but he continued to wear the old one because it was more comfortable. Finally, in desperation, when he was away, she sneaked the suit out of the closet and gave it to the Goodwill. The next day, he went down to the Goodwill and bought it back. This indicates what a suit of clothes will do. And our habits, our attitudes, and our personalities are clothing. They are something that we wear, and we have become used to them. We have lived with them so long that they feel just right. Because with the outfit that we now have, we have reasons for every mistake we make. We know exactly why we are frustrated when we do our best. We know we are misunderstood by everyone. And therefore, we have a kind of warm, cozy feeling about sticking to ourselves in all emergencies. We are going to get what comfort we can out of retiring into the personality that we have developed. Now, when we are just born into this world, lots of people feel that the personality has not yet been developed. It is obvious, however, that either Mendel is right, and that there is a law of heredity, or else there is something that brings back into this world attitudes which go back beyond the present embodiment. We do not come here simply brand new. We come here burdened by perfections and imperfections, by all kinds of complicated chemistries not only within our bodies, but within our minds and emotions. We go along day by day, instinctively building our preferences. What we instinctively prefer, we gradually transform into our code of life. We one by one take all the weaknesses that we have and extol them. We transform these weaknesses into assets. And little by little, we come to the point where we are content with ourselves. And if anyone else cannot get along with us, so much the worse for them. We are going to be what we are, we always have been, and we always will be. Now, this is probably excusable in some cases. But many people are not satisfied with what they are, nor are they satisfied with the place they have in life. They would like to do something better. They would like to be more successful, better organized. They would like to have more natural happiness and enjoy better friendships. They would like to have children who respect them and an employer who honors them and needs them. Most of the things we really want to achieve are hampered by the dispositional instincts within us. The personality we have built within ourselves comes into conflict with the world around us. Other people are not going to be so tolerant with our inconsistencies. Other people are not going to go through all the layers of our personality to find a hidden motive which we have not revealed in daily conduct. So by degrees, the person we are destroys our chance of being something else. And in nursing the various complaints that we have, we continue to strengthen the frustrations and limitations with which we have been naturally endowed. It becomes obvious, therefore, that in order to actually improve life, we have to break through the subconscious pattern of acceptances which we have long endured. We must, in some way or other, break out of the shell which we have placed around ourselves. Some years ago, an individual said rather wisely that it would be good for every person if they could step aside and watch themselves go by. Instead of being the center of something, they should be at some time in life merely one in the mass of things. They should look out upon themselves as they look out upon total strangers. They should recognize that there is a need for a new analysis of our own inner constitutions. If other people are having trouble living with us, it is a sign that actually we have trouble living with ourselves. Always the difficulties that others object to flow from some deep hidden source within our own natures. To meet this type of an emergency, we must therefore, some way, really try to find out what is moving us inside. We must try to break through patterns that become stronger because they are comfortable and well established. We can become psychological attitudes burdened, just like an alcoholic. If we have a bad disposition and nurse it long enough, it is going to be something that we will take to the grave and probably beyond. Therefore, we must somewhere along the line really try to break through the patterns of attitudes which are to our own way self-defending, but to the world they are self-defeating. This means we some way must try to find out what is wrong in our own integration, which is bringing with it mental, emotional, physical difficulties. Now, there are several possible answers, but they're all unsatisfactory for the most part. There are various sciences of analysis which we can turn to. Some people find some answers in palm reading, others in phrenology, some in graphology, some in psychoanalysis, some in astrology. But these are all efforts to interpret the inner person by someone else or by ourselves. And there's a question as to which is the worst. The other person knows less about us, but we know more about ourselves than is good for us. So most of the answers are not found. One simple thing to do is to look around and find out where difficulties have developed or are developing. If we find that for some reason, utterly beyond our comprehension, someone doesn't like us, we must stop simply assuming that they have the bad disposition. We've got to begin to wonder what is wrong with us. Now, sometimes it may be the other person's fault, really. But then it is nice to discover that for a fact rather than to assume it. Because in most cases, difficult dispositions are equally responsible for their consequences. So if we find something that has burdened us for a long time, it's a good plan to see if we can isolate the cause. If we discover that we are too critical, or that we are too fearful, or as very often is the case, we are living in the past, or in few cases, living in the future, too far in the future, we must begin to work on these things and stop taking the attitude that other people must accept us as we are. If we insist on this philosophy, then we must be willing to accept other people as they are. And this is where the rub generally comes in. We expect to be accepted, but we do not feel it responsible to accept the consequences of our own actions. So one way to try to get into this problem is to contemplate the situation as it is. Why are we in this world? Why does it happen that 4.5 billion human beings living together on one planet have no internal communion? They have no communication, except perhaps an occasional psychic demonstration or mystical experience. But as far as being able to know the core in each other, it is impossible. Even if they explain it to us, we don't know it. Because an explanation is not an experience. The experience itself is the thing we have to constantly consider. One way, of course, of increasing knowledge of other people to some extent is to stay with them over a period of time and watch the way they act. This is helpful, but it shows a bad disposition, perhaps, but it doesn't answer the question why. How did this disposition come along? Why has it been endured over a period of years? And why does the owner of it fail to recognize the infirmity? Well, one of the answers to this seems to be that knowing that we cannot really ever understand another person totally, then we have to try to live in a world with other people, assuming more or less that the separateness is hopeless, that it can never be bridged, and therefore that each individual must do it his way. And in failing to do it his way, he gains no reward or no satisfaction from other people. Well, we can normally work with several of these problems. Let us imagine for a moment, as one of the Greek philosophers did, that each of us lives in a beautiful bubble, a round bubble that we call a magnetic field or the aura. This bubble encapsulates us. We are in it. And in this bubble, we live and move and have our being. This bubble is a little universe in itself. And in the midst of this little universe is the being inhabiting it, surrounded as, in a sense, environments on the outside by worlds and continents and habitations and inhabitants and all kinds of complicated situations, all within the magnetic field of the body itself. When you dream, you don't necessarily have a small dream. You may dream being out on the ocean. And yet the ocean you're dreaming about is inside yourself. Yet it can be just as real as though it was the middle of the Pacific. Therefore, within this bubble is a complete way of life. a kind of way of life that must have come to Robinson Crusoe when he was wrecked on a desert island. The individual within his bubble is more or less isolated completely. Everything that happens to him happens originally within this compound. A kind of alchemy is constantly taking place. The world around him only sees that aspect of him which results from the consequences of his character development. They see what he does, but they do not see what he is. They see the circumstances, but they do not understand why he has such circumstances. It is hard to understand why some person is very unselfish and another is completely self-centered. Yet the chemistry of it all works out in this mysterious inner bubble of life in which we live. And this inner bubble is more or less bordered or surrounded by a shell, the shell that separates us from any other living being. Even when these shells come close together and bump each other, still they are separate. And each person living in a separate universe has to face his own problem. This is one of the reasons why, in the old philosophical systems, it was pointed out very clearly that we are in this world to grow. And grow is not the result of other people pushing us and pulling us. Grow is to unfold the potential within ourselves and to perform a magnificent alchemy of transformation in our own natures. Each individual must grow himself. He can enjoy a company or associations of other people. He cannot grow for them, and they cannot grow for him. Anything they can give him will not contribute to his essential growth unless it is good advice and wisdom. Even that is not likely to be very efficient. Each person must start out from within himself and change himself into what he wants to be. It's a mathematical formula. If you want to accomplish certain things, you have to build for those things. If you want to be an electronic engineer, you cannot just drift along and enjoy yourself year after year. You have to take the necessary studies. You must also study very carefully, too, if you want to be a good husband or a good wife. You have to study if you want to find contentment or happiness. You have to study in order to grow, in order to think, in order to build. You must also study to strengthen moral character, intellectual attitudes, and deepen the values of life. All this must be done inside yourself. Now, the result of an individual doing this type of thing within himself is a new relationship with society. It is a relationship which in some ways may not be entirely satisfactory. The old person with the faults will not enjoy the relationships that a good life will give him unless he has earned that good life in the meantime. If he deserves a better life, he can have it and will then like it. If he does not deserve it and tries to have it thrust upon him, he will dislike it even when he gets it, if he gets it. So each person in this capsulated universe in which we function is faced directly with the problem of growing up inside the bubble. He must use his own inner willpower. He must develop such faculties as will give him the intelligence to measure himself. Now, one or two things are available to him to help him out. Nearly everyone sees examples of attitudes around them. These attitudes, as seen, however, are not therapeutic or developing in themselves. The fact that another man stops drinking does not guarantee that you will. Or that another person is more honorable in his dealings guarantees your honesty. One thing is certain, however, by laws of secondary causes, that if an individual observes a certain characteristic and observes that this characteristic is valuable in the advancement of life, he has the right to try to use it himself. He has the right to challenge a poorer attitude within himself and try to supplant it with a better one. If he finds that temper fits have damaged his career for many years, and he finds someone who has controlled his temper and is advancing in his careers, this is a good object lesson. The man who is controlling his temper cannot control it for the other person, but he can give an example. So relationships in life are almost completely examples. They are nothing in themselves unless the individual does something with them. But there are in the world magnificent examples. There always have been since the dawn of time. Those that we honor as the great teachers of humanity were persons with great examples. And they are remembered and loved and honored, not just because of what they said, but because of the internal wealth of character which they exhibited. They were superior beings in a sense. Not superior because of wealth or because of greater education necessarily or of early and better family background, but they were individuals who had the qualities of integrity. And these persons, many of them died poor, some of them were martyred, but nearly all of them had attained an inward maturity which later generations honored and accepted as proper. So from various examples, we can begin to sense values that we can develop. Also, we will observe in other people certain conditions which we may term obnoxious. There are people whose attitudes are just unbelievably impossible. There are people who only have to be somewhere in order to ruin the place. There are individuals who can disrupt anything. They have no patience, no understanding, no social maturity. They're just impossible. So, it's sometimes a good idea to look and see if by some chance there's something of that kind lurking in us. Do we find it easier to criticize than to commend? Do we find it better to doubt than to believe? And in doubting, do we doubt in a nasty way? Now, this is one of the problems that comes along at the moment. In the world we live in today, nearly every attitude we hold can be subject to doubt. We doubt the merchant, we doubt the lawyer, we doubt the doctor. We doubt almost everyone. But the mere fact that we doubt them does not corrupt them. The answer is that we have to learn to be cautious, not to give in to superficial temptations, to hope for the best, to search for the good, but be sufficiently intelligent not to be imposed upon. Instead of being mad upon at the individual who imposes upon us, it is very much better not to have been imposed upon in the first place. So almost every attitude that we have that is objectionable is rooted in something in ourselves that is not right. And the problem is to try to find out what it is and use it in correcting the world in which we live. Now, among other things, of course, we realize there is a larger world of governments, of nationalities, of races, and we find that on these levels in the human being that there are very few people who are not prejudiced. Prejudice is one of the great faults. Prejudice is the individual who asks the various parts of himself what they think, and strangely enough, they all agree with him. They agree with him because he has given them no right to do anything else. Prejudice, therefore, has to be sought out and carefully corrected, or it will destroy life. The old philosophers told us very good information on these subjects. When in doubt, do not hold a prejudice, and realize that there's no way of saying that all the dogs in the world are exactly like the dog that bit you. The fact that an animal bites us does not cause us to condemn the kingdom. The fact that an individual of a certain nation or race is dishonest does not justify us in hating everybody of that race or nation. The fact that political problems rise does not make it possible for us to justly condemn generalities. Condemnations must be built upon knowledge. No individual who thinks from the top of his head in the form of prejudice can be certain of his judgments. But there is no one more certain of his misjudgments than the prejudiced person. He knows he's right. And why he knows he's right is because he's decided he is right. And this goes on, and you try to get the answer from him. And it goes all around. The neighbors have told him, the press tells him, the commentators have said so. But he does not actually know. So prejudice is something that no one is entitled to. Instead of being prejudiced against a person, we must either know they are right and support them, or know they are wrong and leave them alone. We cannot just go out and condemn them. If they can't meet our standard of life, then they have to meet their own standard. Everyone has to in the last analysis anyway. Same is true of religious intolerance. Religious intolerance is one of the most painful experiences of the human being. And the most interesting part of that is that of all the abstractions, of all the uncertainties that have never been thoroughly clarified, a religion is it. No one can really prove physically any religion. He can only prove the consequences of belief upon himself. If a religion makes him a better person, it's a good religion. If it doesn't make him a better person himself, it is of no value. But to dogmatize on religion is one of the great prejudices of humanity and has been responsible for the Inquisition and misery from the beginning of time to the present day escapades of Khomeini. Prejudice is fatal. It is the basis of wars. People do not fight wars over principles, but because they lack principles in themselves. So each person isn't going to be a warrior. Each person is not going out and carry a flag of some kind. But each person can destroy a certain amount of their own peace of mind by their attitudes. Now, there's another important point. If, by any chance, we are convinced that other people are all wrong and then we are right, or if we have very great difficulty in trying to understand the motives of those who disagree with us, we must ask ourselves a more basic question than all that. If we are right and everyone else is wrong, and every other person feels the same way we do, what happens to the universal plan? What happens to the infinite purposes which nature has set forth? We are aware and convinced from even the perspective that we have that there is a plan behind life, that there is a reason for being here, that there is a purpose in existence. If these things are true, then we cannot assume that each individual must change somebody else, or that altogether we are incapable of working together on any constructive project. We know that the effort to unite humanity is the great problem that we face today, and that differences of opinion, unless they are held in a kindly way, are guaranteed to divide mankind still further. A disagreement with our neighbor, leading to bitterness, is just as certain a destructive value as if one nation declares war on another. So in order to advance the plan of things, there must be some kind of rightness that we are all supposed to have in common, or can develop as the need arises. So all the way through this problem of thinking, we realize that we are confronted by a challenge. And this is the challenge, is to put ourselves straight with life. And by so doing, discover that life itself is straight. The individual who is prejudiced, opinionated, self-centered, egotistical, antagonistic, can never understand a law of love in life. They can never fully comprehend, even in themselves, the divine plan of which they are a part. Unless the individual puts his own life in order, he can never discover universal order. So with all these temptations and allurements and problems, the question always comes back to the same one, namely, what can we do ourselves to help this matter along? Well, one thing that people have tried doing with some success, also with some difficulty, they have asked other people to estimate them. They have said, I'll give you a half a dozen people, a piece of paper and a pencil. You're all my friends. at this point. Now, I'm going to ask each one of you to write what you consider to be my worst fault. Don't sign your names. I know the handwriting anyway. But anyhow, when you get the message back, look it over. And instead of saying, "My Lord, what kind of people do I go around with?" you can always ask yourself, "What kind of people are they going around with?" including yourself. You may get some useful help in that way, but it isn't the answer, because the habits and temperament that you show arises from something else that is much deeper within yourself. You were probably a child. Maybe you were not a very happy child. Perhaps you had difficult parents. Perhaps you grew up under difficult circumstances. All these things are possible. But when we reach maturity, each individual has the right to take over his own life. And many people never make it. Many people in their 60s and 70s cannot get over the grudges of their childhoods. They have never recovered from the fact that they were neglected or orphaned or had step-parents or adopted in an orphanage. They cannot get over the personal grief of long ago. It does one of several possible things to them. It causes them to be saddened and defeated because they cannot compete with those of more secure background. The second thing, it makes them antagonistic to society. It may prevent them from making a good marriage later. And they may very well be that they'll take it out on their own children in due time if they have any. So when you come to 21 years of age, it's time to realize that at that moment you become a person. At that moment you break through the shell of childhood and adolescence. From that time on, you are no longer able to excuse your attitudes by impulses or instincts. At the time of majority, it means that the person has taken over the management of his life. Now, if he takes over the management of his life, he's either a good manager or a bad one. If he's a bad manager, he may try to spoil himself, cater to all the weaknesses and faults that he has. If he's a bad manager, he may also resolve to pass the miseries he has over to anyone he can get hold of in by way of revenge. But if he is a good manager from that point on, he will outgrow the faults of the past. He will forgive those who despitefully used him. He will clear his mind of all grievances and will start in with a fresh slate. Now, a fresh slate is a very important thing, because a fresh slate means that you are not bringing forward the past. Well, that may be easier to say than to do, because while you're hard at work rejecting the past, it is sneaking back at you as memories. And while you're just going along fine, you suddenly remember all the misfortunes of early life. This makes it very difficult. So there's no way of saying that those things didn't happen. There's no way of saying that you were neglected. But there is one way of approaching it, which says, all of this was a lesson. What did I learn? I'm deprived while it's a lesson, but I'm not deprived if I transform this lesson into creative, conscious self-improvement. If I can forget the incident and take the lesson and use it for the rest of my life, if I was not well treated as a child, I will treat children well. If I was neglected, I will not neglect others. If I was deprived of certain privileges, I will never deprive others of those privileges if they are entitled to them. Little by little, we transform an experience into soul growth, a way of becoming greater than we were, more than we are now, and working toward the future. So out of the old things, we come finally to majority. Now, majority is rather tricky, because there seems to be some little difference of it in climates. Actually, apparently, in very tropical regions, the individual matures very rapidly and is as physically and mentally and emotionally as old as 16 as one in the temperate zone is at 21. This is a climatic problem. Now, there are also psychological climatic problems. the individual coming forward into the atmosphere of his own existence, which is trailing with it all the mist and fogs of the past, may not make the 21-year adjustment that is supposed to come along. It may be 30 before he reaches it. And it's not unusual for him to maybe reach 80 without getting the idea. He doesn't get the message. By that time, incidentally, he's apt to be going into a little bit of second childhood, and then he will remember better than ever all the misfortunes of his early life. All of this is a rather unfortunate state of affairs. So we can only say maturity comes when you wake up. Maturity comes when you face the facts, or when you are tired of being inadequate, or are tired of being hurt all the time, or tired to have nothing but false friends, or make bad investments. Whenever time in life you come to the conclusion or the realization that you must take hold of your own life and live it, perhaps in the spirit of the Sermon on the Mount, until then, you cannot hope to have the values and benefits which you aspire. No amount of study, no amount of thinking, no amount of reading will work unless it be transformed or transmuted into internal growth. After you read the book, if you're not a better person, there's no sense in having read it. This is what the Tibetans always have said. In Tibet, a very backward, primitive country, according to most people, they have no literary fiction. The Tibetans say they don't believe in making up stories, even if they're good ones. But if it isn't true, it isn't worth reading. Well, you see what we're getting in literature today, you'll appreciate the integrity of the Tibetan point of view. We're getting material now that the more you read of it, the sicker you get. And if you can't stand that, you can turn to your television and have a complete breakdown. So, mere reading, even though it is constructive, won't do it. But you can divide. You can say after a certain program, I feel better. I'm inspired to do something more useful, creative, constructive. That's a program you can watch. But if the program ends by your saying to yourself, good heavens, every one of my neighbors may be a murderer, this isn't any good. The constant glorification of crime and delinquency, while it may have a great appeal to the little ones, any individual who is not motivated to improve through his avocational efforts is still an immature person. So the one who ties himself down to a television and watches nothing but Western and Aunt Want ads, which are very numerous these days, simply hasn't gotten to that maturity period which we mentioned. And because of his attitudes, his life has very little in it that is worthwhile. Now, another problem that we've related to this is a certain satisfaction with achievement. An individual, to be really happy, must be self-sufficient in living. He must be able to live a reasonable life and enjoy the things that he can do to make his life better and the lives of others better. He must have a plan of some kind, even if it is a very simple one. If he can't do anything better than make a pair of shoes, he can always plan to make a better pair. Everything in life depends upon the person having purpose. Inconsistency within the individual has a tendency to destroy purpose. If one part of your nature says that nothing but corruption exists, another one says, I'd like to get away from it all, and the third one says the only way you can do it is become an alcoholic, this is a type of internal confusion that is always destructive. No matter what the person is, he must give. He must do something to justify the fact that he exists. In other words, while we're in this world, we have to pay rent, whether we know it or not. And we're not paying rent to the landlord, and we're not buying condominiums, but we are paying a kind of rent in which it means that we must, all of us, earn happiness, security, and peace of soul by action in payment. we have to have the coin of the divine realm, which is good deeds. Without this type of thing, there is nothing we can do to solve our own problems. So there's always this big value ahead that we can improve. And by improving, can gradually outgrow in ourselves the sources of our own misery. I know a great many people who have had very interesting and perhaps profitable careers in some respects. And I know that most of them are not ready for success. The individual who by mental adroitness achieves a certain status in society is in a very precarious situation. By fortunate or unfortunate circumstances, by one skill alone, apart from the rest of his temperament, he may achieve what he terms success. But this one faculty that gave him success is not enough to help him to use it wisely. Therefore, he is destroyed by the other faculties that do not know how to carry the burden of achievement. This is something we all find in the matters of education, and it is a problem today. We can become well-educated. We can get a good job as a professor in a university, or we can go out and develop a profession.